This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett.
House prices are soaring. Second-hand cars are at the most expensive ever. And if you go out for a bite to eat, you won't get much change out of a £50 note. And that's before you start on the £30 cocktails. Prices seem extortionate. And it's no different for the stock market either.
I am afraid, unfortunately, everything is looking pretty expensive no matter which way you look at it.
That's Duncan Lamont, head of the Strategic Research Unit at Schroders. For instance, currently the S&P 500 index of US large companies is valued around about 38 times its average earnings over the past 12 months. To put that into perspective, that's more expensive than at the peak of the dot-com bubble at the end of 1999, just before one of the biggest stock market implosions of the last four decades. It's also one of the many reasons over the last 32 years when you might have had good reason not to invest in the stock market. But like buying that expensive cocktail at the end of the night, mine's a rum old-fashioned, by the way, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't.
I think the message here is quite clear. Embrace the risk according to your preferred levels of risk as an individual, and don't let the uncertainty derail your plans. Don't let that uncertainty allow your amygdala to run riot.
That's Stuart Podmore. He's an expert in behavioural finance at Schroders. Stuart and Duncan are joining me on the show to take a trip back to the future. We're going to discover what's history's lesson for investors in times of turbulence and what to do when stocks seem at their most expensive. In part one, we're going back just over three decades, a period in which the stock market has endured some of its biggest shocks.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So let's start by going back to 1989, which was a pretty eventful year. George Bush became President of the United States.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
The Exxon Valdez ran aground, causing the worst oil spill in U.S. waters.
The tanker, the Exxon Valdez, had just loaded more than a million barrels of Alaskan crude. It was about 25 miles from the Valdez terminal and was apparently trying to dodge ice flows from the nearby Columbia Glacier when it ran aground.
The World Wide Web was invented.
It spans the globe like a superhighway. It is called Internet.
There were protests in Tiananmen Square.
From Tiananmen Square, the sound of gunfire sounded like a battle, but it was one-sided.
The Berlin Wall fell.
People scrambled playfully up and down on the Berlin Wall itself, something they used to be shot for.
It was an eventful year, but just the start of what was to come over the next three decades. The last 32 years, in fact, have included some of the biggest stock market shocks in history, the most recent of which has been triggered by the pandemic.
The Dow is now down nearly 900 points. That is just over the course of the last 34 minutes since we have been on the air, right? This is a drop of nearly 3%. We are now inside correction territory, all of it connected to the coronavirus. I want to go back to CNBC.
It caused the global economy to all but shut down. COVID-19 was the major contributing factor to three of the 10 biggest one-day falls over the last four decades in stock markets. Yet while COVID produced some of the largest one-day falls in stock market history, by the end of 2020, most indexes had recovered their losses, although some, such as the UK, had fallen nearly 10%. But that was modest in comparison to other yearly falls experienced since 1989. The 1990s began with the world falling into recession, and global stocks ended 1991 down over 17%. Then came a recovery, but the hubris and largesse of the mid to late 90s gave way to reality in the early years of the new millennium. The turn of the millennium proved difficult for financial markets. In 2001, global stocks fell 14%. The next year, they were down by another 16%. And by the end of 2003, they'd fallen a further 18%. This was in the wake of the bursting of the dot-com bubble at the end of the 1990s when highly rated technology stocks were sold off. But it also coincided with the devastating attacks on the World Trade Center in New York in September 2001. And a period which also saw a global economic slump. Following that period, we started to recover. But just as the recovery was gaining momentum, the global financial crisis hit in 2008.
It was one of the most profound events in generations, with huge consequences for the American economy and households throughout the country. This was the time a decade ago when the financial crisis erupted, a crash that most experts did not foresee. Its effects and of the recession that followed on income, wealth, inequality, and our politics are still with us. Tonight, our economics.
It began with the gradual collapse of the housing market in the US the year before, which led to the worst global recession since the 1930s. By the end of 2009, global stocks had shed more than 40% of their value as the global financial system ground to a halt, crippled by bad debts and excessive risk-taking. And yet, despite all the turmoil, and there have been plenty more since, had investors kept their nerve and remained invested in stocks, they could have been better off. For instance, according to findings from Schroders, £1,000 invested in the FTSE All Share Index at the start of 1989, with all income reinvested, would now be worth around about £5,750. That's annual growth of 5.6%. Now compare that with £1,000 hidden under a mattress at the start of 89. That would now be worth £428. That's due to the effects of UK inflation. And that means an annual growth of minus 2.6%. £1,000 left alone in a UK savings account at the start of 1989 would now be worth £1,818. And that's annual growth of just 1.9%. All those figures have been adjusted for inflation, but don't take into account any charges or fees. For the full story, just search for 32 Reasons Not to Invest or schroders.com/insights. But there are some interesting things to consider when looking to invest. The first is the effects of inflation.
Yeah, so inflation basically just describes how much the average price of goods and services in an economy are rising over time. So it's basically saying, how much would your money have to grow at so that you would be able to buy the same goods and services next year as you were able to buy this year? If your money grows at a lower rate than inflation, then over time, your money can afford to buy less. Your purchasing power falls. And over long periods of time, this can be a big deal. Just very simply, if we assume that inflation is positive over time, so the average price of goods and services increases over time, cash you leave under the mattress is guaranteed to be able to buy less in future than it can today. So that money is clearly earning nothing if it's just sitting under your mattress or in a money tin in your kitchen. Whereas the things you want to spend that money on, the price of those are going up over time. So that's why that purchasing power falls. If we think about it instead, maybe with savings rates, in the past, it was quite possible to put your money in a bank account, earn a rate of interest that would be higher than the rate of inflation. Nowadays, you're lucky if you can get much more than maybe 0.5% in an easy access account. Latest 12-month consumer price inflation reading for the UK came in at 2.1%. And in the US, it was a whopping 5%. So all of that money invested in savings accounts that's growing at 0.5% a year or thereabouts, that's fallen in value once you adjust for inflation. The prices of the things you want to spend it on have gone up by more than the value of those savings.
And the miracle of compounding.
Yeah, I like to think of this like acorns. So from an acorn, a tree can grow. And from that tree, more acorns can grow. And then when those acorns fall to the ground, they can grow more trees, from which we can grow more acorns. This is effectively what we're talking about here. You invest some money in the stock market, and there will be some income that will be received through that investment, the dividend payments. If you reinvest those dividends, that is like planting those acorns. You earn a return then, not just on the initial money you put in, but also that extra money that's gone in there as well. And over time, those acorns can grow into forests. In the same way, your initial money can earn dividends, can reinvest those, then you earn more dividends on that increased amount, and it keeps growing and growing over time. It really is a powerful tool, and particularly the longer that you invest for, the more powerful this can be in helping to grow people's wealth.
Yet, despite all we know about high inflation, low interest rates and the benefits of compounding, people remain obsessed with just leaving the money in savings accounts. In the UK, for instance, 1.2 million people opened a cash individual savings account, otherwise known as an ISA, over the last year versus 300,000 who opened a stocks and shares ISA. It appears the undulating stock market during the pandemic was too much for many to stand. But that's reflected the world over in terms of savings, and it seems to be people's attitude towards uncertainty and the associated risk.
I go back in answer to this question to understand what's going on a little bit for advice from actually our regulator, because the FCA conducted a financial live survey in 2020. And here's a direct verbatim quote from that survey. We want more people to invest. And what they did was they based it on the comparatively meagre cash returns that cash savers would have enjoyed from 2008 to 2018. So we're looking at a slightly different time frame here. But the fact is, this is a message that's coming from the regulator. If just remember that if people are to achieve their aims in life, whatever those might be, investing has got to be part of the plan. And people will have to place capital at risk in order to achieve those aims. And that's the very clear message that I think should be directed towards people who are putting money simply into cash. Unless, of course, they're putting money into cash as at the start of a financial plan. All advisors recognize, of course, that one starts with a cash-based savings that then becomes an emergency base of cash, but that investing has to be part of the plan. And remember what we said earlier, risk is not the same as uncertainty. And with investment risk, we do have insight into probabilities, thanks to people like Duncan, who analyze markets and look at historical returns. I think the message here is quite clear. Embrace the risk according to your preferred levels of risk as an individual, and don't let the uncertainty derail your plans.
But what do we do as investors when we feel that risk is extreme? As we previously mentioned, stock markets are expensive relative to historical comparisons. So that's what we'll discuss in part two. But before we take a trip all the way back to the 1800s to see what history tells us about investing in markets that appear to be at their peak, we'll start with where we are now.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
Imagine the scene. It was February 2020. I know, not so long ago, yet it feels like another lifetime. Most stock markets, just like now, were at or near all-time highs. US stocks, for instance, were on their longest bull run in history, climbing ever higher for nearly 13 years, fueled in part by low interest rates and central banks pumping cash into the economy, a fallout from the financial crisis. Despite constant concerns over how expensive stocks had become, nothing seemed to be able to break their stride. Then the pandemic struck.
China is battling a new and rapidly spreading respiratory virus. The number of people infected has tripled to more than 200. And President Xi says
US stocks fell by over 30% in only 25 trading days. It was the quickest and sharpest fall in stock market history. It ended their bull run. Yet, by mid-April, they were up almost 30% from their late March trough, and some of the biggest companies in the world were back trading at all-time highs. And they've been going higher ever since, despite the lingering effects of the pandemic. That's not just US stocks. Stocks around the globe seem precipitously high.
I am afraid, unfortunately, everything is looking pretty expensive no matter which way you look at it.
Duncan takes a regular look at how expensive stock markets are using five very common measures across five different regions. UK, US, Japan, Europe, and emerging markets. You can find out more about his methods and results by searching which stock markets look cheap.
And of those five countries, five valuation measures, so 25 in total, only one of them is cheap compared with its median average of the past 15 years. 17 of them, of the 25, are more than 20% expensive, and several are more than 50% expensive. It's the US which really stands out as being quite eye-wateringly expensive.
Ah, the US, the gilded lily of stock markets.
And the S&P 500 hitting a new high on Friday.
As you can see from the bottom of your screen, that the NASDAQ has hit 9,000 for the first time ever.
And for that US market, we can actually do this ultra-long analysis and look back at the cyclically adjusted price earnings multiple. So what this does is it compares the price with today's share prices with average earnings over the last 10 years, and it does all that in inflation-adjusted terms. And we can look at analysis in this all the way back to the year 1881, so 140 years of data. Right. Point to note, there are always issues with any really long-term analysis like this. The companies in the stock market today look very different to those back then, but the cycles we see in human behaviour repeat time and again. Those cycles of fear and greed that repeat time and again, they're just as relevant. So this long-term analysis can serve as a useful yardstick. And it shows just how expensive the US market looks. It's currently trading on a cyclically adjusted price earnings multiple of almost 38. The long-term average, about 17. The only time in history it has been more expensive was at the very apex of the dot-com boom.
The apex of the dot-com boom. That was back in the late 90s and early 2000s. It was a time when pretty much anything with dot-com in its name was floated on the stock exchange and investors went wild for. It, of course, ended in tears. Most internet stocks, as they were referred to back then, fell by the wayside, although a few survived, some of whom you may have heard of.
Amazon. Low prices anytime, anywhere.
Life comes together when you buy, sell, eBay.
But just because a few survive, is that proof enough that investors shouldn't necessarily sell when markets are so expensive?
You could certainly make a pretty strong case for cashing in your chips, but actually it's painfully tough over the years to identify market tops. The thing with valuations is they can be a useful guide to long-term returns. So high valuations tend to foreshadow low long-term returns, but they are next to useless about giving you any insights about what might happen in the near term. And the big, big problem here actually is that even when markets seem uncomfortably expensive, they have a habit of becoming even more so before they top out. So we did some research into this, again, looking at the data over the back past 140 years. And actually, our analysis found that shifting fully out of stock, so saying, I am scared, I'm going to sell my shares, on the basis of what appear to be intimidating valuations, historically, that has been a losing strategy. It might make sense to temper your exposure, but a drastic kind of all-out, all-in kind of decision for your portfolio, it can have pretty drastic consequences for your future wealth.
But just how drastic?
So, first of all, the cost of getting out too early. So what we did was actually we looked at if you assume that you feel uncomfortable whenever the stock market is 50% expensively valued compared with its historical average. And I think for most people, that probably would be a fair assumption to make. Well, over the last 140 years, there have been 14 times when this has happened in the US stock market. Some only last a few months, but some last for several years. So meaning on average, when the market breached that 50% expensive limit and you thought, oh, I'm scared, I'm going to sell, on average, the amount of money you would have left on the table was a return of 43%.
If people get nervous when stocks are 50% more expensive than the historical averages, then those nerves would be shredded by now. According to Duncan, at current levels, US stocks are more than 100% more expensive than their historical averages. In fact, we've not seen these sorts of levels since the days of the dot-com bubble.
The point here is that even though the markets, even when the market seems expensive, it can keep going up. And to give maybe a few concrete examples, you would have been out of the stock market since about 2013. So you'd have missed out on most of the last decade's worth of stock market returns, barring a few scattered months. You'd have sat out not just the later stages of the dot-com bubble, but also the earlier years, and most of the years in the run-up to the financial crisis. So actually, if you are solely using valuations as your guide as to make very big decisions with whether you should be investing in the stock market or sell your shares for cash, that can have quite severe costs in terms of returns. But it is, without a crystal ball, it is actually very difficult to know when those market tops are going to come. So that's why the idea of tempering your exposure perhaps, or looking, as Stu was saying, to think about adjusting some of the exposures within that market. Maybe you've had lots of you've done very well from being invested in lots of technology companies that have done very well in the US. And actually, there can be opportunities in maybe the value style or in some of the non-US stock markets that have not performed as strongly and which are cheap compared with those large US companies. So adjusting your portfolio at the edges, looking for areas to rotate some of your exposures into other areas that might be more attractive, those can be quite sensible things to be thinking about. But just looking at the headline numbers and saying, I'm scared, I'm going to sell all my shares, that's a bold step to make. And to be honest, when we look at tales historically of people who have been able to time these tops historically, you've got to remember, you're looking at the survivors there, not the many people who tried that and failed and got it wrong and lost a lot of money as a result.
As Duncan mentioned, history is littered with casualties when it comes to selling at the wrong time. In fact, Schroeder's analysis of investing in the FTSE 250 index revealed that over the last 35 years, mistimed decisions on an investment of just £1,000 could have cost investors nearly £33,000 worth of returns. For instance, if at the start of 1986, you'd have invested £1,000 in the FTSE 250 and left that investment alone for the next 35 years, it might have been worth just over £43,500 by January 2021. That's according to Refinitiv data. Returns include income reinvested but aren't adjusted for inflation or costs. And bear in mind, of course, that past performance is no guarantee of future returns. However, the outcome would have been vastly different if you'd have tried to time your entry in and out of the market. During the same period, if you missed out on the FTSE 250's 30 best days, that same investment might now be worth just over £10,500 or nearly £33,000 less. For the full story, search Time in the Market or visit schroeders.com/insights. But looking back at what history tells us isn't always the best guide for what to do now. As Duncan's already explained, while we can say that some markets have never looked more expensive compared to history, it's difficult on any measure to call the top of the market. So what should investors be doing now? That's what we'll discuss in the final part of the show. Investors face a challenge. Rock bottom interest rates and low returns in many assets versus stock markets that appear prohibitively expensive. Those thinking about investing or those thinking about selling face the same difficult question. What should they do next?
Let's just think about it from two perspectives then. We've got people who are already invested and we've got people who are considering investing at this point in time when the market looks pretty toppy. Well, if you're already invested, I think the starting point here is that if you need the money if for a specific reason, if you need to disinvest, and that specific reason was always part of your financial plan, or even just some sort of spontaneous treat, for example, that would require disinvesting, then I think I would say go ahead and disinvest and use it. That's why many people invest in the first place. That's why you invested. Just remember, of course, the longer you are out of markets, the harder it becomes to reinvest. And I think it's worth quoting at this point Jeremy Grantham from a GMO article in March 2009. He said that seeking the optimal is a snare and a delusion that often increases investors' paralysis. So remember that. In terms of those people who are looking to move into the market when it's particularly toppy, then just remember that diversification is key. But I would advise advisors and consumers, investors, to just try and go beyond that well-worn phrase. We've heard it all the time, haven't we? You know, beware of putting all of your eggs in one basket. I think here there's an opportunity to reframe the client conversation, to just change that context a little bit.
Similar to actually what happened in 2020 when the market is falling, there are things that happen in the external environment, whether that's valuations, markets falling, markets going up too fast, markets going down too fast, that make us think we need to do something. And there is tremendous pressure on us to react, to sell some equities right now, to want to sell equities last year as well. And actually, just temper the strength of your response. Think about your long-term plan and why you're investing. Try not to be buffeted too much by what's going on in the short term in the market, because long-term returns from investing have been really strong. And the likelihood is, if you make a really binary all-in, all-out decision, you will probably come to regret that at some point in time.
When people are looking forwards into the future, they don't know how things are going to play out. And this is where we get into the territory of uncertainty versus risk. And risks typically are those that can be measured, typically where we might or might not understand some of the probabilities, whereas uncertainty is, it gets right to the heart of human emotion. I was reading a piece by Liz Moore recently in Thinking Times, and she was just reflecting on the fact that the amygdala in the brain is the emotional center of the limbic system. And this, you know, this can really run amok when we start thinking about uncertainty. And Duncan's absolutely right. You can keep that at bay. You can resist that by simply thinking about the things you can control. And I think making one enormous binary call is extremely risky. Maybe making a few larger steps perhaps might be right, whether you're going into markets or out of markets. And also remembering when, like I said before, when it might be necessary to disinvest, and therefore taking away some of the emotional burden of that decision. We see some clients at the moment, for example, who are getting close to the lifetime allowance in pension investing, and therefore if they are not comfortable running the risk of perhaps a significant tax bill in the future, then disinvesting or ceasing to invest, that decision is made for them in the context of their financial plans, and therefore life becomes a little bit easier emotionally as well. So there are all sorts of ways around it.
We should be humble, I think, in our ability to get these really big calls to sell all of your shares or to move all of your shares into a particular area, right? The chances of us doing that successfully are quite slim. And actually, just holding back on some of the emotional triggers which are going off is probably a more sensible approach.
Well, yeah, we often expect people to be humble and to put the emotions to one side. But as you know, David, I've previously argued that that's impossible. I think when it comes to time in the market and not trying to time the market, I think as I said earlier, advisors will recognize it's really important for clients to build up cash at first. But I would recommend doing that in parallel with investing. Certainly, well, I can remember when I was younger, sooner the better in terms of investing. I mean, people have many more options today to do that. I remember when I was a young army officer, you know, all I had was a TESA. It was tax exempt as a savings account, but there were fellow army officers who discovered investing through personal equity plans, as they are known, or PEPs. And I used to laugh at some of my fellow army officers because they'd come in and look at their statements over morning coffee and say, "Oh, good grief, you know, I've lost my plan has gone down." And I'd sit there rather smugly and think, "Well, mine hasn't, but in the long term, I missed out." So I think it's also worth remembering that when you're thinking about market timing or time in the market. Accessibility, liquidity is important for investors as well. And I would also argue that the management of expectations is particularly important at the moment. I think we all know how to manage expectations around savings. Duncan and you, David, have demonstrated that very clearly today. That's the easy bit. With investments, of course, it's a little harder. But I think the point that comes through time and again is thinking in the long term and thinking about those plans in the long term, setting up those plans to work for the long term and then actually forgetting about them is probably the best approach. And I think if you want to remain happy and contented while investing, in spite of the fact that markets might be moving around, I would steer you towards UCL, University College London's Cognitive Decision Sciences and Neurosciences team's recent release of the mathematical equation that defines happiness. It's a mathematical equation. I won't bother trying to quote it now, but actually put simply, it talks about the fact that in order to achieve happiness on a moment-by-moment basis or daily basis, we should lower our expectations, but not so low for so long that it makes us unhappy. I think that's a pretty good mantra for long-term investing, particularly at the moment with what we've described in terms of valuation, that not expecting too much from markets is a good starting point. And I think we could be in a good place for the longer term if we adopt it.
Here's what else investors are talking about.
Institutional investors are expecting an improvement in returns despite the long-lasting challenges created by the pandemic. The annual Schroders Institutional Investor Study, which polls 750 industry professionals in 26 locations around the globe, showed an average expectation return of 6.4%, up from 5.6% a year earlier. Almost half of respondents estimate that the average annual total return will be above 6% over the next 5 years, with 13% expecting returns of more than 9%. You can read the full findings by searching Schroders Institutional Study or by visiting schroders.com/insights, where you can find much, much more.
Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us about anything on the show or give us ideas for future shows, you can email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. If you want to listen to the Investor Downloads back catalogue, and why wouldn't you? You can go to schroders.com/the Investor Download or rate, review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every other Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.